Welcome, everyone. If you have interest in learning how someone took $30,000 and grew it into a $30 million real estate portfolio, you are going to want to listen to what Oben Olsen has to say. On to the intro.
Welcome to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show. Each week, you will learn how to grow your wealth through real estate investing. Be introduced to the players that are getting it done and learn how you can get involved. And now, here's your host, Darren Batchelder.
A little background on Oben Olsen before we start the show. Oben was in the media business, where he and his brother produced films with global distribution in over 50 territories, through very well-known companies such as Sony, Best Buy, Redbox, and Walmart. Oben then focused on studying and learning how people become wealthy, and he concluded that most wealthy people become wealthy through real estate. Let's listen in on his journey of taking massive action to acquire real estate and grow his wealth. Now on to the show. Hey, everybody, we've got Oben Olsen here with us today. And Oben, I really appreciate you coming on the line. Just want to thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, great to be here. Olsen Capital Investments also is our company name.
Fantastic. Oben is a extremely experienced and multifamily investor, and he's got a lot to share today. So the first thing I want to do is, Oben, can you just share a little bit about the first deal in Charlotte? I know you've got a large deal in Charlotte. You've also have another one in the Dallas area. The Charlotte deal came first. You know, help us understand how you got that deal, you know, some of the challenges and how that deal is performing.
Sure. Do you want to start with that deal, or do you want to start with my first real estate deal?
You know what, if I'm good with going with the first real estate deal, or we could just jump into Charlotte and go backwards. It's totally up to you.
Okay. I'll kind of give a 30,000 foot historical on real estate with us. So, you know, as you may or may not know, we were in media before we were in real estate, and I had a successful media company, production company in North Carolina. We had a lot of clients up and down the East Coast. They won all the awards and, you know, put together a good team and were really kicking ass. And we were pretty far ahead of our time in that arena with a lot of digital technology and a lot of the new stuff that was coming out around 2005, 6, 7, 8. And as everybody knows, especially people, you know, our age, 2008 was very similar to the coronavirus in a way of just the bottom dropping out everything.
Right.
And, you know, at the time we were doing really well in the media space, and then the bottom literally dropped out because the first thing to happen was everybody cut their advertising budget. So hospitals, tourist destinations, cities, I mean, you name it, all of our major clients basically put a complete freeze on everything they were doing, just like they're doing now with coronavirus.
Right.
And I think I had bought my second house at that point, and the first one I bought to live in, the second one I bought to live in, but I bought the second one with the idea of taking the first one and, you know, leasing it out and having its mortgage paid for. Cause I kind of figured out, hey, somebody else can actually pay down your debt. That's essentially the same as income behind the scenes. And I was dabbling in that. And I bought a single family house right before the crash. I mean, really within months of that disaster. As a second house to live in, and eventually I thought I wanted to do something with it, possibly turn it into some type of an investment, but to live in it. So what ended up happening is we paid way too much in hindsight for the second house, and ended up living in it because there was no real option to do anything else with it. The first one was still renting out and covering its note and everything. And I started kind of figuring out, you know, going to lend local lenders and local banks and stuff, figuring out how, what a refinance is, what a, you know, what a loan is, what a mortgage is. I mean, this is stuff that I didn't really know about, and just started delving into it because of a few things I'd read.
Read where? What were you reading? Different books to get into the real estate?
At the time, we were struggling trying to figure out how the real games are played in the world. I mean, what is it about other people that look completely normal and the same intelligence, the same drive, the same everything that we had? What was it about them that got them millions of dollars ahead?
And you came to the realization.
And once that became a critical focus, just like any skill set, right? You start delving into that skill set and learning how it's done. And somehow I figured out that, you know, real estate was, I think I saw a pie chart one time and it was like of all the millionaires in the world, you know, it was like 70% are doing it in real estate, and the rest of them are all the other things that people do combined, all the businesses, all the sectors, all the facets, everything.
Isn't that crazy? I see that same thing all the time. 70 to 90%. I'm like, it's crazy how big real estate is in terms of
development. So that really lit a fire under our butt to like figure it out. You know, at the time, you know, spending countless hours and days just delving into the weeds of all up and down. I mean, we were building our own first digital cameras before people were. We were building drone helicopters before people were. We were so deep into media and images and image creation that we were creating our own hardware. We were working with HP and Adobe and NVIDIA and stuff. We were sponsored by them. I mean, we were as deep as you can get in this stuff. But the finances weren't you know, equal to the knowledge base and the dedication.
Right. So now you built your business in the media space. It goes into a quiet period during a down economic time. You start educating yourself on the real estate space and decide to take action there. You buy a second house and rent out your first house, and you start to want to delve into that real estate world more.
Yeah. So what happens is, you know, we our business is doing okay. We got our second house, and then the bottom falls out of everything. But by that time, I had been figuring out what was going on and how the whole game of real estate works. So when the bottom fell out, I mean, it was just like, this stuff is worth $150,000 a piece and I can buy it for 40, 50 and 60 right now. Like where do I grab the money? How do I make this work? Because this is like a once in a lifetime opportunity. And so what essentially started happening was I figured out that, you know, up or down market, you got to have a good credit score. If you have a good credit score, you can get a loan. If you can get a loan, you can buy a property. If you can buy a property, you can fix the property up. If you can fix the property up and put a renter in it with a 1-year contract, you can go back to another lender and reevaluate the property. And possibly or likely, if you did all those steps correctly, get your money back out of the deal and own the property with nothing in it, and still be cash flow positive from the rent if all your metrics and all your numbers line up. And so right after the crash happened, you know, I was still in the middle of learning the whole ins and outs of the entire supply chain of how real estate works and how the banking system works. And just, it was just massive opportunity. So I ended up in 2 years or less buying like 10 single family homes, recycling the same like 30 grand that we'd saved up. And so I thought that was it. I thought this is, you know, this is, I'm done. I'm good. You know, I won't have to worry about where I am in 30 years anymore.
Right.
So obviously getting a taste of, hey, you can buy a property, and if you do it right and you buy it right, you buy it at a discount compared to market value, if it's in good shape, you know, you can essentially build a business without ever raising a dollar from anybody. and keep recycling and reinvesting. And I'll back up a little bit. I mean, as far as being a diehard real deal investor, for whatever reason, I've pretty much been that way my entire life through necessity, not through study. And what do I mean by that is, like, you know, when I left home at 18 and had, you know, $1,800 in a car that sort of worked and drove across the country to pursue a dream in media, there are certain things you have to do. To get a job, you have to show a resume. To get a gig, you have to show work you've done. To do the work, you have to have skills and you have to have equipment. To get the equipment and the skills, you have to have experience. To get the experience. So there's all these catch-22s, right? So I'm going, okay, I'm aggressive. I'm an ex-athlete. I'm aggressive at 19 years old, and I'm going to do this no matter what. So I start by osmosis realizing the only gold digging climb up is reinvesting.
Right.
So I learned that really, 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 really early on that, hey, you know, you take a job, you take all the profit from the job, you put it back into equipment, you buy better equipment, you go to a bigger job, you have a bigger resume. Now you can get people to work with you and for you because you got an even bigger job. You can afford to pay them, reinvest all that money back into them and a bunch of more stuff. Before you know it, you have trucks, you have trailers, you have a studio, you have, you know, daytime Emmy Awards, and you're literally, you've climbed all the way through whatever that sector industry has to offer, you know, and this could be landscaping. And for me, it was media, you know, it could be plumbing. I don't care what it is, but the concepts, the core concept directly leading to massive success were being taught to me by myself through necessity to enable the next level up, the next challenge and the next bigger project.
Right. And what I really applaud you on when you said was, you know, okay, so now you're in the media, you get into real estate, the crash comes 2008. And what you did was recognize a massive opportunity and you took some capital that you had and you educated yourself. But, you know, after educating yourself to a point, right, there's always more to learn, right? But after educating yourself to a point, you actually took action
and massive action
and you bought 10 single family homes. So then after, and a lot of people that get into real estate investing start with single family. So that's a very, you know, it's a very common, but then after you invested and you saw the gains by investing in those deals, how did you get into multifamily?
So to fast forward, you know, past the becoming an investor by osmosis, right, through necessity, where I was going with that was, you know, it's the reinvesting game. So what do we do when we have 10, right? We have 10 and now our value's increased. Even in the down market, our value's increased because we've put 20 grand, 15 grand, 5 grand, 3 grand, whatever they need, we put it into them. We've got them operational. We've got money coming out of them. So now their valuation is higher. So I turn around and I start to learn the finance game. I start to figure out how banks work. How does banking work? How does banking in general work? You know, what is debt? What is equity? What's the capital stack? How do all these puzzle pieces actually go together? Who benefits from what? And how can I create things in the universe and the known world that we live in that have value to all parties at the table? That's really, really critical. Because if you don't have value to all parties at the table, then you're not going to have something that flows. Because if you're providing value to all parties at the table, then and only then can you be assured pretty much that you are also going to be rewarded for that. So it's up to you to put the puzzle pieces together to figure out how to create value for all parties involved so that you can be automatically rewarded. It's what we call the automatic, you know, the automatic reward success formula. So fast forward, I've done the 10 single families, right? And I'm still, and the market's starting to come back a little bit. And so we do a spreadsheet, a single spreadsheet. It asks the question, what if Because the question, what if, is an extremely powerful thing to ask. Because if you present yourself with a question, or your group with a question, or whoever with a question, it is a natural outcome to answer it. And then it gives you insight into the future. And you can do that through, you know, spreadsheets for real estate. In the movie industry, you do it through concepts and ideas. You go, what if, you know, what if we didn't have gravity? What if we could play with time?
Well, I'm guessing the what if was related to the real estate.
Yeah, all those great inventions of in any sector are almost always based on asking the question, what if? And that's why I always tell people to question everything. Because if you don't question everything, you're taking things in a different way. And when you question things, you become creative. And when you become creative, you create and design things that you either you don't know, or other people haven't done, or a combination of both. It gives you, guess what? The big O word, opportunity. So fast forward, you know, I've got the 10, so we create the spreadsheet. The one and only spreadsheet that says, what if we did X, Y, and Z? What if we took all these lines of credit that we have for our media business from all these different banks? What if we took that money? What if we took all the money that we all have individually together? What if we found a deal that was X and we did Y to it, and we assumed the rent was, you know, another variable? What would our financial picture look like in 12 months and 24 months and 36 months, right? So when you answer that question and you go and you build it out into a spreadsheet, you go, holy cow, if I can find X pricing on X amount of product, then, right, in X amount of time, it's going to be worth approximately, you know, A to C, whatever that range is. And so you start playing with this stuff and you see, holy cow, you know, there are formulas here to be made that you can create your own wealth in the future on a spreadsheet right now with some assumptions and variables. And so we did a sort of outline like that and said, you know, this is it. Like, we can literally go from deal to deal to deal, and in less than 10 deals be multimillionaires if we do it correctly, per, you know, what we've been doing, what I've figured out, what I've found.
So basically, by asking that question,
go ahead.
By asking that question, what if, you guys came to the realization that you had a bunch of untapped places to grab equity from, lines of credit, and if you could take that unused line of credit in various different places and then leverage that into new real estate deals, that would produce a ton of cash flow and then eventually more net worth.
More importantly, a ton of equity. I don't really care about the cash flow. I care about the equity. I care about the value that we create. Because the value that we create on an exit into another value creation vehicle, the next deal, multiplies so fast, it's crazy if you do it right.
So you make that decision. Now you have to go take action. What did you buy first in the multifamily world?
So we kind of, you know, like I said, we outlined what's possible. Then we said, okay, this needs to happen. Market conditions are dictating. We're in an up market. You know, this is the time to do it. And so we basically, like I said, we pulled together everything that we had, all the capital and cash that we had, family and friends. And then, like I said, we used all the unused lines of credit that certainly weren't earmarked for that type of usage, but what does the bank know if I can get in and out quickly?
When you say it's you and your brother are partners on this, correct?
Right. And at the time, my dad was an active partner as well.
Okay.
So, we take the credit we have available, and we take the equity and the cash we have available, and we go buy 10 2001 built townhomes from a bank. Remember, this is after the crash, so there was still, you know, 50 cent on the dollar product out there.
Sure.
And we found half of a townhome community that was, you know, bank owned, and they took 57 cents on the dollar for 10 units.
Awesome. They're
basically like class A, class B, nice, you know, maintained. The rent was terrible, $700, $600 rent, and a 13, you know, and at least at the time, $995 rent easy is what it should have been. The management, the company that was running for the bank, they don't care as long as it's full and not upside down on, you know, on the bank's note. So we saw tremendous value add opportunity in just basically turning the place around, getting out the lower end people that were there and putting in the you know, sort of class B, low class A that it deserved. And that was basically the play on that deal. And so it was what we call a management renovation play, which is the best thing in the world if you can find it. And that's where you go in instead of spending, you know, all the energy and money with hammers and bulldozers and really physically fixing the asset, you go in and find something that's being mismanaged. Right. And you can do that in businesses, you can do it in real estate, you know, you can do that in a variety of ways. And the beauty of it is the multiplier on that. You know, it is what it is. So you could double or triple the value of the asset pretty easily by, you know, doubling the net operating income or whatever it comes out to be that you need to do to it. So we did that. And I think like a year later, we refinanced it and got like an extra $600,000-$700,000 out of that deal.
Awesome.
That we didn't have to start with. So we get our down payment back out plus an extra $600,000-$700,000. Plus, we still have our bank lines of credit and everything for our business that slowed down. And we said, okay, we've done the spreadsheet. We know what we have to do. We got to double up every time. So we went from 10 townhomes to our next deal was 96 single family, very low income, very bad, poor condition portfolio. And at this time, you know, we own 10% downtown of that town where we were. So it was a pretty big move. You know, it got press and everything. But it's like I try to tell people, I started with $30,000 and now we're sitting on $30 million of real estate almost.
That's crazy.
And we haven't had a single investor along the way. We haven't done anything to go raise capital. I'm now trying to figure that game out, $30 million in, because it looks like it is something that we probably should have learned in the beginning, but we didn't need to because we figured out how to do it without that. We had figured out how to make our deals make more deals. And that's very, it's different than most people. It's a much harder road to hoe because every deal has to practically double up over and over, or it doesn't work. So I have to work a whole lot harder in real estate than let's say a syndicator would, but at the same time, I own 100% of it.
Right. Right.
So it's a real different animal. So we took the 96 on. It was absolutely horrendous managing and trying to maintain them. I went through manager after manager after manager, because just to drive all the homes and even look at them would take 3 days. It was hell. And so we just said, no, this is like, I don't even care. Break even, whatever. This was a bad move. Never get into these again, especially not in bulk. And a couple of years later, we sold them. And but let's see, in the meantime, yeah, we sold them. And once we were free and clear of them, we made a little bit, not a lot. I mean, compared to the size, I think we were up maybe, I don't know, maybe $500K or something, which, you know, is a lot of money, but not compared to the size of the deal. They just resold again and somebody made like $5 million. But that's just how that goes, you know, and I didn't want to deal with it. I knew the value was there. I knew if I went in there and spent 2 to 3 years and renovated every single house, we could easily get the $5-6 million value pop. But I didn't, it was too slow. I didn't want to do it. So we just ended up selling those And then our first real big multifamily commercial deal was Charlotte. And this is 2016. And, you know, by that time, the market is really was really starting to dry up. I mean, there were before buying Charlotte, I remember driving around Atlanta just looking at, I mean, tens and 20s of, you know, huge apartment communities just sitting there for 30,000 a door, 40,000 a door, 25,000 a door. It's just like, it
how,
was just
how big was the Charlotte deal? How many units?
125
units.
So by the time we got to the 125 unit size, the market was almost dry, almost non-existent. It was literally one of the very few remaining in a great area, bad assets in the country. And we were, by this time we were looking nationwide, and it had been on the market a lot, but it was in such bad condition, it scared everybody off.
What do you mean by bad condition?
Just falling apart exterior and, you know, very low income, unruly tenants, just a very much of a D-class situation. Owners that were terrified of their own asset. Their dad built it. They didn't know how to run it.
What was the occupancy?
Low, like 80%.
Right.
Rents were crazy low, like $600 rent in Charlotte market, which is, you know, $1,100, $1,200 rent market. So we took on our first hairy monster, you know, and I literally went up there and sat, you know, lived on top of it, figured out how to run property management software, figured out what a manager's job is, hired a manager, and then just started going crazy and running crew to rehab and renovate it. By this time, you know, with my 10 singles, I'd had the experience to know how to do that. The funny story is
Oben, can I jump in here for a second? Because one of the things that, so we met through Instagram, we got together for dinner in Dallas when you were here looking at a deal. And one of the things I remember from that conversation talking to you and your brother was, which was, you know, it was a challenge that you went through on this Charlotte deal, but I think it also taught you guys a ton about how to manage it every deal going forward. And that was, you mentioned that you hired a general contractor to do the rehab, and then you ended up, changing up. So help the listeners understand, you know, what went wrong? Why'd you have to make a change? And then I love the idea on how you guys look at actually developing, you know, what things should cost before you even actually, you know, go out to bid.
Yeah. So, you know, we got the deal in Charlotte. We were all excited. We put together a rehab budget. You know, we thought, okay, we're gonna stroke a check on this. You know, we're going to be able to hire a general contractor, and this is gonna be great. It's their little project. They're going to get it done. You know, we're going to watch over it. The work happens. They get paid. The work happens. They get paid. The work happens. They get paid. And then we're finished. And we thought it was going to go back basically like that. Well, it turns out that general contractors in general, as far as I can tell, until you find a really good one, are a group of people who don't have anybody's best interest at heart except for theirs in every single step of the process. So it went from a dream of doing that to, I remember one time I drove to the property and I was walking around looking at siding and stuff that was going on. And I just looked at it and I said, you know, there's like seven guys out here and one's doing work. So I start asking the guys, like, what's going on? You know, and they're like, oh, that guy hired me. And the next guy was like, oh, that guy hired me. And the next guy was like, that guy hired me. So there's like seven layers of people pimping people doing work on the property. And I walked over to a piece of siding and just checking the work. And I literally lifted it up with my pinky finger all the way to horizontal. This is hardy plank siding. I mean, this stuff is tough.
Right.
And it essentially fell off in my hand. I took a photo of that, you know, I remember lifting it up horizontally, putting my head underneath it, taking a photo of the siding sticking out over my head like a roof, horizontally and sent it back to the general contractor. And I said, you're fired. And I don't want to see any of your people out here anymore. I will run this show to the finish line. Thank you very much. So,
which, you know, that's got to be scary. You know, you're not a general contractor.
No, right? Absolutely not. But I know how to run a show, because remember, we did production with media, and then by this time we'd already produced like 5 feature films and had a studio in Atlanta. So we transitioned everything to Atlanta by that time. And
well, I know how to run a show. Yeah, so you knew how to build a team.
So I'm like, you're fired, you're out of here. And guys, who out here is good? Who out here can work with 3 people or 2 or 3 people as helpers, and that's it? Who out here can I give you, you know, 70 square feet of work? You can handle that mentally and physically and get it done, and then I can give you 70 more square feet, because nobody out here seems to have any idea how to take this whole thing of 9 buildings and figure out how to even divide it up and conquer it. So obviously there's going to need to be a team leader. Obviously there's going to need to be somebody that figures all this out and basically doles out little pieces of work one at a time to very small teams, lots of little small teams everywhere. And that's how this is going to work, because that's what they can comprehend and handle. So I've got to figure out how to run that show. So it ended up being that, you know, and by the time it was over, you know, 8-9 months later, I'd been there on the ground the whole time, 8 or 9 months. And I'd, you know, identified people who were capable. I mean, by the end of it, I'm running these people's businesses for them. I'm going, okay, so you think you can get it done this amount of time? This is what your materials are going to be. This is what your labor is. And I do the math on their labor and how many helpers they're going to have. And I go, dude, you're going to be upside down $10,000 at the end of this job at that price. Do you realize that? No, man. I mean, we're going to make it work. Did you just gave me the time and materials and how many people. I know how much you have to pay your guys. You're going to be upside down. So I end up running these guys' businesses for them so that they won't literally go upside down and can finish. You know, and it's like, okay, all right. So,
well, that's big for you, because look, if you just let them go down that path and then they go upside down, then, like, to your point, they're most likely not going to be able to finish the job, and you're going to have to go out and find other workers. So,
yeah.
So you built a win-win scenario.
Yeah. I ended up splitting it up. I probably had, I don't know, 5 to 10 teams out there all at any given time, you know, rotating them in and out, and just ran it like a general contractor should. You know, with my best interest at heart instead of theirs. So it got done on time and on budget. And, I, you know, we brought it in. I don't remember what the numbers were, but I know it was a good probably quarter to half $1 million below what it would have cost to have a GC do it.
That's huge.
And so it turned it from an absolute shit show to a success through my knowledge of being able to run a team. And my persistence of not giving up.
And that you took action early in the process, right? I mean, you know, somebody else that was running the deal may have let that general contractor go for another, three months before they made that change. So
yeah, they would have 50,000 more in the hole and gotten no work that was even acceptable or you know, and with no permits and all the rest of it. It would have been right. A complete fucking show. This guy was used to that. He's used to people rolling over and taking advantage and him being able to take advantage of them. And that's what a lot of these guys love. They're huckster hustlers with an excuse, you know? And so
you recognized it early and took action. That's awesome. Now, when you guys talked about the Dallas deal, you kind of married up your experience there with, you know, buying a large deal in Dallas, and then you guys basically said, hey, we can figure out what everything should cost based on, you know, when we talk to, you know, the general contract, we ask how many people it was going to take to do the job, what type of people are going to be there. And then you actually go and do the research and you know what the hourly rate is for those people. So you kind of can back into what he should be charging plus whatever his margin is. So that you have a good idea, where I think a lot of people, when they're getting into the large multifamily space, you know, they don't really have that knowledge. So it's all kind of guesswork.
Yeah, they get eaten alive all the time. I see it constantly. But let's back up a little bit because I want to finish out the Charlotte, and then that's going to segue straight into Dallas. So 9 months in, you know, we paid 6.2 or something for Charlotte. And, you know, like I said, rents were under market dramatically. So while we're working on it, I find a great manager, and he's literally doing the renovation to the tenant base on the inside of these units, just like I'm doing the renovation to the outside. So by the time we're both done at about the 9 month mark, well, it took him probably another 6 months, but he was getting close. We had a turnaround success on our hands, right? And what does that look like financially? But, you know, we were hoping for like an $8 million valuation. We're like, that would be awesome. Well, we go back and get a new appraisal with our rent now where it is, with the place looking good, and they, you know, the comps that they pull, blah, blah, blah. And they send us back, I think it was like a $12.5 million appraisal.
Are you kidding me?
I'm like, I just made almost $5 million in 9 months. Where in the, with no MBA, with no real knowledge, just getting out there and slinging it and forcing it to be a success. Where in the world else can you do that quickly?
That is amazing. And that's a deal that was fully marketed, that was sitting on the market for a long time. Nobody wanted to touch it because it was scary.
Yep. Terrified of it.
And you, how'd you get past the fear of getting into a deal like that?
Because it was that or we're finished.
Finished.
You know, it was that or we are financially done. Like, I don't know what else to do. You know, this is it. This has to work. And so we just poured all 100% resources into making it, forcing it to be a total success.
Oh, but I love that statement. You know, this has to work. You know, there's, I think that's a key component, you know, when you're looking at successful people. I remember somebody asking me what, maybe two or three career paths ago, somebody said, well, what are you going to do if this doesn't work? And I was like, well, I'm just not thinking that way. I'm thinking about what do I have to do to make it work, right? And there's going to be stumbling blocks that come along the way, and then you just have to kind of adjust, right? So that's huge, huge.
We call it incoming missiles. They never stop.
Right, exactly.
And see, a lot of this comes from, you know, for me, being able to go take on something that big like that with that much risk and owing, you know, $50,000 a month in debt or whatever it was, like, I don't think there's a lot of people out there that could do it, like, just cold hard like that all of a sudden. And the reason that we are able to do it, the reason my brother and I are capable of that is because we went through the hell that is making movies at the, you know, at the $5, $6 million level, where you have an actor, you know, for $300,000 for one day, and then it rains and you're out in the middle of the boonies and you have an action sequence you have to shoot, and you have to figure out how to get it done. There is absolute failure is 100% not an option, military style. And so you get trained to be an absolute monster. And if I hadn't had that, this thing would have scared me to death, just like it scared the current owners who owned it. They were so afraid of it. They would sneak around and show us the property and like whisper, you know, and the management that was controlling them, the tenants were controlling them. It was like this gigantic, they were so happy, so thankful that somebody got it out of their lives. And so that's the other side of the coin, you know? So what's the path forward to becoming that kind of person, right? It's A, doing real estate like we were doing and slowly building one deal after another, you know, over more period of years and a slower build. Or it's B, it's who you are. You know how to develop teams. You know how to run giant projects. You know how to withstand and sleep at night with massive amounts of debt over your head that you may or may not be able to pay and be okay with it. and be a Navy SEAL. And that's where we, that's where we had gotten to as human beings at that point. And that's why we were able to do this project and just, I mean, listen, the down payment for that project was like 12 bank line of credit. I mean, I was using borrowed money that has a 12 month expiration date. If you don't pay it back, they're coming after you. Completely the wrong thing to do, but the only thing that would grab the property.
Right.
So we not only were we on a renovation loan that I think it had like 24 months maturity, or they come bankrupt and take the property back from us, but we were also using the down payment. It was the same deal. So it has to be a success. And when you're in the position of, I don't care if it's a movie or running a corporation or real estate or whatever it is, an athletic event, when it has to be a success, your mindset is different. Then, I want to do this. I'm thinking about getting into that. I'm this. Yeah. It's what I call the Navy SEAL attitude.
Yeah. I would agree. And earlier when I asked you about, how you overcome the fear, people have asked me that before and you answered it, you answered it by saying, look, we, in our prior career, we had to do it, right? So now we're in a different industry, but we had the confidence that we could do it because of, your prior experience. So sometimes it's, you run across something that you haven't done before, you're scared. But sometimes if you can think back in your own mind about another time you were scared and you took a chance and it worked out, that can sometimes propel you forward.
Well, I actually had an actual fear awakening and I'll never forget it. It happened during production on one of the bigger movies, and it got so bad. We don't know if we can finish this. We don't know if we can keep it going. The money's running out. Is it going over budget? It got to a point where I had to make a physical choice, a conscious physical choice. And that choice was this: either A, we keep going and we do this and we win, or B, we get so afraid of fear that we get petrified into a corner and it will self-destruct. And so I had to look at it. I had to look at fear consciously in a very, very, very conscious manner and say, this thing is like a disease. It is killing my ability to perform, and it needs to be consciously focused on and eradicated, because it is no longer needed. We are not in the cave. We're not in the woods with caves and sticks and the wolves chasing us and fear is saving us. It's a completely different game we play now. We have not dropped fear. Fear is directly linked to caveman living, and we have progressed so quickly past the need for any kind of fear in our modern society's fabric. And we're still holding on to it as a throwback, and it's stopping everybody. So once I had that realization, as we all do, when you see something, you can turn it over in your mind and figure out why it's pointless, how you can get rid of it, and how you can focus on elimination of the problem. But it starts with the realization and the understanding and awareness that it is a disease, A, B, it is no longer needed, and C, it is my duty to control it and eradicate it. And once that happened, I became totally different. What happens is when you get past fear, you become, 10 times stronger, because the fear, even though it may still be there, it certainly is still there, it still crops its ugly head up and then gets a hammer to it. it's there. You know what it's doing. You know how it's hampering you. And then and only then you can start to control it. And so when I became totally okay with failure, the point was I had to become 100% okay with total failure and what that meant. And so I started adding it up. what does total failure actually mean? Does it mean your mother doesn't love you anymore? No. Does it mean your wife doesn't love you anymore? Well, if the answer is yes, then she wasn't really a wife anyway, so no. Does it mean you're going to be hungry? No. Does it mean you're not going to be able to transport your body from place to place to start over or do whatever it is you need to do to grind back up? No. Does it mean you don't have a roof over your head? No. Because somebody you know is going to throw you a roof. It's going to throw you a lifeline. So once you start adding up what total failure actually means, you're like, dude, this is fine. I can always go to fucking Walmart and greet, you know, or McDonald's and flip. I mean, that's total failure.
Well, not everybody looks at it that way. So, I mean, that allows you to take risk, take managed risk.
Yeah, so that was the awakening. I was like, okay, so if total failure is not really that bad, then why the, you know, bleep am I letting this fear control my success? It's insanity. It's crazy. So after that point, you know, that then I became free of the devil. You know, I became free of fear. And at least consciously able to control it, manipulate it, put it back in its box, tell it to go F itself and step past it. And when that happens, when you have that awakening, you become a monster. And what I mean by that is when you don't have that fear, you can make logical choices to take gigantic risks that are calculated, obviously. You don't just gamble. But you can make that logical choice to take gigantic risks and build anything you want. And Elon Musk is a perfect example of that, among many other people who are monsters. But it's all a methodology in your mind, and you have to unlock a bunch of key elements to be able to do it. So after that, you know, it became easier and easier to do bigger things, and you know, here we are today. So we had the success on Charlotte. It's now humming along. It's got a new loan on it. I've got all my money back out of it, plus $2 million. So now our liquidity is at like 3 or 4 or whatever. Remember, never put a single dollar outside the first 30 grand into it, you know, as far as investing.
Crazy, crazy, crazy good.
And now we're on to the next deal.
So now, you know, you had the mentality of kind of doubling down every time. Do you still have that mentality, or as you get larger, do you do, you know, it more in more sizable chunks, or do you keep doubling down?
So what happens is as you grow and as markets change, you can't keep the exponential going. It's just the way it is. You can't find big enough deals fast enough. You know, everybody else is sucking them up and the market's going up. And so the dynamics change. The dynamics of the market change, you know, all the time. So what ended up happening is, you know, we couldn't find anything on the market for 2 years. I mean, I was flying all over the place looking for stuff.
So help our listeners understand kind of what is the type of deal that you guys look for? Because I talk to a lot of syndicators that are, you know, that are in the value add space, you know, 95% occupied. They're just, you know, we're going to rehab the interior units or the exterior and the interior, raise rents, but you know, it's agency finance, long-term agency financing. Your deals, the occupancy is much lower. The, you know, the deferred maintenance is much higher. So the rehab is much higher. And because it's not 90% plus occupied, I'm assuming you're taking on personal guarantee loans. I don't know if that's the case, but most likely bank personal guarantee loans. So, you know, talk about how you source deals and like when you tell somebody, this is the type of deal we're looking for, because I think it's different than a lot of the syndicators I talk to.
Oh, totally different. Yeah. I'm looking for garbage. I mean, I buy trash.
So when you see the single family signs that say we buy ugly houses, like you guys are like,
we buy ugly apartments,
right? Communities, large communities, but
yeah,
that need a lot of work.
Many doors that are rotting and falling in as I can find. I mean, because look, there's a perception thing to all this, right? a guy who has somebody else's money, who's going shopping to buy a deal to make somebody else a return and get, you know, 20% for himself, has a completely different outlook of what he needs and what he wants than what you know, Olson Capital needs and wants. That guy needs something that's safe. He needs something that's predictable. He needs something that he's not going to get his hands dirty in. He needs something that he can get regular, high quality, low cost debt on it. And there's no questions on what's going on. And that's his business model, right? So the beauty of real estate is there's tons of business models on top of the same asset. It's what you want out of the deal and what you're trying to achieve that dictates what you're looking for. So in my case, right, while the syndicator is going out trying to find a 5 cap, you know, stabilize, he can bump the rents $30 and you know, in year two, and you know, spend a little bit of CapEx and, you know, increase the value over the next 10 years. That's a success to him. That's a total failure to me. And here's the reason why. If I do that route, I do one deal and I'm dead. I have no more capital, no more money, and I have no more movement, no more growth. Why? Because I'm going to sink my money to that deal and I'm not going to be able to get it back out. Okay. So since I'm using my own money, I have to buy disasters. And here's what happens. The syndicator is terrified of what I buy, and he should be. It's going to take a lot of work. It takes a lot of risky money, and it looks scary. To me, I see gold. I see discounts. You know, I see 50 cents on the dollar. I see a major discount. I see a whole lot of work ahead of me, and I see a double up in 12 to 24, 36 months.
So
what happens is they don't want to touch anything I look at, and I don't want to touch anything they look at. So these deals will, you know, sometimes, and there's definitely guys like me out there, and they buy and they're competitive, but sometimes they miss them. And so a deal like Charlotte or Dallas, both on the market, both just hanging out. Nobody wants to touch them. They go over there. They get scared to death. Place is caving in. It's got roaches. You know, the plumbing is all fucked up and the sewage is coming out everywhere and the ACs don't work and the windows are half broken and the tenants are dealing drugs and the roofs are caving in and the tornado took down one building. I mean, it's a real disaster zone. But the thing is I see quick success with a whole lot of risk, and they see total failure because they won't be able to execute.
Right. So you mentioned it earlier, I guess one of the questions I would ask now that you've proven yourselves, you know, with two large multifamily deals, that you've been able to go into these scarier deals and renovate it and increase the value dramatically. I would suspect, I don't know for sure, but I would suspect that there are a lot of passive investors that would be interested in that type of deal, but because it's, you know, it's a hairier deal, they would expect a higher return than dealing with some of the other offers they're getting from other syndicators that are more predictable.
Right. So, and to one last note on my train of thought there, which was like, so which deal is a more dangerous deal, right? I'm going to give you a scenario. A deal that's barely cash flowing, it's a 5.5 cap, you're going to get agency debt on it. If the rent dropped 3%, it would be, you know, 1%, it would be break even, 3%, it would be underwater. It's beautiful. It has no issues. It's highly occupied. It's highly stabilized. And it's a retail market rate deal. Okay. It's beautiful versus a piece of crap that's 70% occupied, that's caving in, rotting, and is, you know, who knows what, owed back taxes. I mean, this is a total disaster from every angle. Well, it comes down to the price you pay, right?
It's the price you pay and its execution, right?
It's the price you pay and its execution. To me, financially, I see a 5 cap and I go, hold on a second. If the market has coronavirus for 5 minutes, this deal's bankrupt. But my piece of shit over here that I'm paying 50 cents on the dollar, I could withstand a 60% occupancy for a year before I was going into bankruptcy.
Right.
But I have to do a whole lot of work and a whole lot of execution to get it from A to where it is to B where it needs to be. And that's the part that most people can't stomach, don't want to do. And for good reason, it's absolute hell. And so therefore they think the safer deal is the clean, pretty, shiny penny. And you know what? Most of the time it is until something happens and then it isn't.
I completely hear you. And that's why I say that I believe that there are investors out there that would look at those opportunistic deals, but they would expect a higher return for that. But right. Hey, let's move on to, you mentioned COVID-19. I know that you have some, pretty bold statements in terms of getting back to work and getting back the economy, getting back going. How do you see this crisis playing out with regards to real estate? Is this like a replay of what happened for you back in 2008? And there's going to be a ton of opportunities that come our way, or do you not see that?
It's a 50-50 coin toss right now for me. And the reason that is because it all depends on what the population wants to do. If the population says, screw this, let's get going, let's get back to the good life, and they right. and they really push hard, then it may be an artificial, dip with some stimulus and we keep going. But
massive stimulus, right? That's a big question mark. Stimulus.
But if people decide collectively that to throw in the towel, then the shit is gonna hit the fan like nobody's ever seen. So I don't know yet where we are. Nobody does. The market represents exactly that, up and down every day, not going anywhere. If it goes negative, which I think there's more than a 50-50 chance. I think it's 60-70% chance it's going to go pretty hard negative. If that happens, it's a cleaning the clock time. I mean, it really is. Like, retail centers and stuff everywhere are going to go bankrupt. I think a lot of office space has a potential to do so because of people also realizing they can work at home, the whole thing becoming streamlined, technology everywhere, filling in the gaps of people needing to move from point A to point B every day, 9 to 5 is completely changing the world. So I think there's some sectors that will really potentially get destroyed. In a really big way, but it may not happen. It may not. I just, at this point, it's looking less and less like it's really not going to. I think we're going to feel some, and real estate 60 to 120 days behind anything, disastrous happening. So it's a very slow moving beast, but
right.
I mean,
right.
The mortgages that are being paid are like four times more of them than, or three times or something like that, more than they were in 2008. I mean, it's a tsunami shit storm headed in that may or may not land.
So let's go fast forward 6 or 12 months, even 18 months. And let's assume that, there is a big downside and it negatively impacts those sectors that you just mentioned. Retail, office, hospitality. Does your strategy change and you start going after those opportunistic deals, or do you stay in the multifamily world?
I think hotels are done, period. They're over. They were inflated. I was trying to buy hotels before all this, and they're way overpriced and way too many of them, way too competitive, man. I would say they are absolutely slaughtered. If anything was a for sure bet right now, I would say it's hotels.
But would invest in those during the correction, or would you stay away?
Yeah, when they're 40 cents on the dollar, I mean, people still exist. It's not like we killed a bunch of people. So eventually they're going to be rolling around using hotels again. So yeah, I think it would be a smart play. Will I do it or not? I don't know yet. We'll just have to see.
Right.
But when it's a massive enough correction, all of a sudden you're buying a 10, 12, 13, 14, 15 cap hotel, and you're like, okay, there's so much money to be made here that it then becomes worth the risk.
So
I remember apartments were tin caps.
Yeah, no longer, right? Not in this day and age. But who knows? I mean, with so far so good on the multifamily route in terms of collections across the board nationally, but you know, we're still only a couple months in on this COVID thing, and we have 30 million plus that are, you know, unemployed, and there's massive stimulus out there, but we just don't know how long it's going to last. And whether
stimulus is a terrible band-aid. I mean, it's good and bad. It's good if you put stimulus on something and then everybody says, oh, okay, all right, fuck it, back to normal. Everybody goes back to work. Stimulus was a total success and amazing. But stimulus as a band-aid to then just prolong the pain is a terrible, terrible idea. So I think the jury's still out on whether or not it'll really do anything.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, so the bottom line is opportunistic, right?
Yep.
I don't care what it is. If it's a car wash, a hotel, a multifamily, a high rise, a condo conversion, a business, a biotech startup, doesn't matter to me. If opportunity is there. And so how do you look for opportunity? Well, you know, it really comes down to looking for the downside. Like the way we look at what we do is very much, and it's, I don't know if it's unique, but it feels somewhat unique. You know, we try to kill deals. Like, first and foremost, we're deal killers. That's what we do. And here's the reason why we do that. We have a huge checklist. You know, we try to kill a deal. Every time that a deal comes across, it looks like a good deal. We try as hard as we possibly can to kill it. Because if you've tried for 2 months to kill a deal and you can't kill it, then there's a good 85% chance that's a really good deal if you just can't kill it no matter what. Whereas the average investor looks at stuff as opportunity and looks at the upside. Well, we could do this and we could make this and we could do that. I look at it and go, I could lose this. I could fail here. It could crumble there. The market could kill it here. Competition could destroy it over there. So when I get out the check boxes and I look at it and I can't check any of the negatives and the only thing left is the positive, then I start getting interested.
That makes a whole lot of sense.
And that has saved our ass I don't know how many times.
So now you guys are, you mentioned 30 million in assets under management. What's next for Oben? Like what's your big stretch goal?
You know, to be honest, because of the market conditions and the way they are, the uncertainty, and just the sheer like grind required to do our model, I think that we're going to change completely what we do in sometime in the future. I mean, I want to be in a position of and to go back, you know, to go back to that article that shows, you know, 70% of all millionaires are made in real estate or whatever. There's another little article out there that's not as well known or statistic. And that is the richest people in the world, most of them, you know, are on Wall Street. So you start studying, what's that all about? How does that work? You know, and then you start to realize, like, hey, if you can manage other people's money and make them a decent return, they will line up out the street, around the block for you to do so. And there's a lot less grind, and a lot less, you know, rednecks, and a lot less physical risk in managing capital than there is in managing, you know, assets like this. From my perspective and my life goals, you know, I don't want to be looking at 500 income and expenses on, you know, on rental properties. I want to be looking at a team managing millions or billions of dollars. So what is the most efficient way to generate capital? You know, and how can we turn what our knowledge is of banking and finance and debt and capital structures? How can we turn this new knowledge that we have through the necessity we had to learn it to do real estate into really? So I call it, you know, how can you get as close to pure as you can? Everything that people do is a black box, right? A McDonald's is a black box. An apartment community is a black box. A car factory is a black box. All these things do, and when they're set up right as a system, is they generate value because they do something society needs, but they are translators. And a lot of them are really poor translators. If you look around at society and you see all the black boxes that people are rendering inside of, most of them are really poor capital translators. They don't do it well. They have a lot of friction. They have a ton of risk. They have a ton of management nightmares. And they basically, I mean, they're great, but if you're really trying to get pure with capital and really a purist point of view, which is where I'm at now, I want the absolute least friction that we can have. I want a team of 10 guys managing, you know, $3 billion in assets, all financially, all on computers, and none of the other real world stuff. So that's ultimately where we're headed, I think.
That's awesome. So right now you're at 30 million and you want to grow to be 3 billion in assets.
Yeah. And I don't want them necessarily to be physical assets. I mean, I think at the end of the day, physical assets are really safe. And I think if you start really generating big returns, you know, in the market or with a fund or whatever, that you're still going to want to. So what we would end up doing is probably rejiggering our whole corporate structure, streamlining all of it and making it so that it's way, way, way less intensive compared to the way it is now. And then we would be able to place the capital that we're playing with, you know, in the markets or whatever, into these, and then the asset, it's okay. So right now the assets are basically these massive growth machines, but I think eventually the assets are going to become basically safe bank accounts. Cause nobody, you can't keep cash. You can't keep money in a bank. So an apartment community is an amazing bank account. It grows at X amount per year. You know, it throws off cash flow. It's, you know, 15-20% return on your equity, internal, external. Like it's a really, and it's stable. And it's real and tangible. It can't just go up in fiat money overnight and disappear because it's paper and it's a number and doesn't exist anyway, right? So I think we will always be attached somehow to – I know we will always be attached to physical assets, but my new challenge is fintech. I want to climb that ladder.
Awesome.
And I want to go back to being creative. I want to go back to working on, you know, on the computer and having teams of people that are intelligent that work on computers with me as, you know, as creators, because it's – that is a really fun team to run. Running guys with hammers that don't can barely even get to work every day is not very rewarding. And so coming from creative, you know, being a creative person in the film industry and in commercials and stuff and being in that realm and then going away from it by necessity to build the pyramid the right way, the survival pyramid the right way with physical assets and to use it to lever up has been absolutely incredible, but we would definitely surpass that and move on. And I think that's the next step.
That's awesome. So timing wise, we're, you know, kind of mid 2020. If I talk to you a year from now, do you foresee having that company established and having a team in place?
Yeah. Yeah. We've already been doing marketing testing. We've already been putting together the pipeline, figuring out the modules and the people and stuff of what we need to what we're going to build. We're still not decided on what we're going to do. I mean, I'm looking at tokenizing real estate, super interesting to me. Quant trading on the markets is super interesting. And my brother is really heavy into that right now, building that out. We've got great tests going. Anything that's digital, that's turning, you know, an asset and a physical asset into, listen, there's a huge problem in real estate right now. It's liquidity. It's a liquidity crisis with the assets because it takes, I mean, just to refinance one of our deals takes like $300,000 in fees just to get new money. Like it's absolutely antiquated and insane how retarded real estate transactions are when we have Bitcoin, we have, you know, online everything at our phone, you know, we have Robinhood in our pocket. Like, so I would love to be involved in some stuff that turns all my assets into a liquid device. Like, you know, maybe we create an app, maybe we tokenize all the real estate, sell off the debt and the equity in an app where you can just buy and sell it, you know, quickly with a push of a button. It shows all the, you know, all the pertinent data right there. So you can make a decision if you like it or not. You can get in and out quickly. Like something like that is super interesting to me. And then just being in the capital markets and you know, possibly putting up together something like Ray Dalio is doing would be really interesting to me. So that's kind of what
Oh, yeah. He's definitely a thought leader in the space for sure. So, Oben, how can people reach out to you if they want to get in touch with you? What's the best way for them to reach out to you?
Instagram.
Okay.
Or email or our website.
So what's your Instagram tag? We'll put it in the show notes also, but just so the listeners have it.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I think it's my name. I don't think it's our company. I had both at one point, but I think it's just my name. I do some mentoring and stuff on there as well.
Yeah, I've got it. Yeah, it's at Oben, O-B-I-N, underscore, and then your last name, Olson, O-L-S-O-N.
Yeah.
Well, Oben, I really appreciate you coming on the show. It's an amazing story how you took $30K and turned it into $30 million in assets. And now you're at $30 million in assets, and now you're pushing a goal of $3 billion in assets at some point later in life. So that's amazing. Appreciate you sharing with all the listeners. And next time you're in Dallas, we'd love to get together again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the closing, be quiet, Rico, my dog. I think in closing, you know, what it's hard to share, like what's the most valuable thing you can share with somebody. But I think one of the key defining, you know, things that exists that people just need to really take to heart and understand in their soul and in their bones is how can you create value for somebody else? Because what happens is if you can crack that nut, then you're automatically rewarded. If I can make somebody else more money than they have right now through a service or a product or something that I'm doing, either A, make them happier, or B, make them more money. Well, I'm focused on making more money because I know as soon as I figure that out, they will literally line up around the block. And of course, I'll be rewarded. And so if I'm one person and I'm able to do that, and there's 6 billion people on the planet, and I can reach all of them with the internet, this is a simple, you know, it's a simple job of cracking the code of how can I create value for somebody? That's all it is.
That's a great, great, great point. Great point. Once again, Oben, really appreciate you coming on the show. I think that you've taught everybody a lot of life lessons, not just real estate, but just life lessons and how to attack business.
Thank you for listening to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show at darrenbatchelder.com. If you liked the episode, please provide us with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. If you already provided us with a 5-star review, then thank you, and please share the show with a friend.